This tape contains the 21st in a series of teachings on the Book of Luke, presented by the Reverend John W. Howe, rector of Truro Episcopal Church in Fairfax, Virginia. The 21st teaching is entitled Signs of the End, and the scripture reference is Luke chapter 21.
Turn to chapter 21 of Luke's Gospel. Luke 21, it says, Jesus looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw a poor widow put in two copper coins, and he said, Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them, for they all contributed out of their abundance, but she out of her poverty put in all the living that she had. We know that story, usually called the story of the widow's mite. In fact, it's the widow's mites. She put in two coins. And Jesus calls attention to that because her gift of the two coins was literally all that she had, whereas so many others had given tremendous large sums of money. We'd look at those sums and we'd be astonished and impressed, but in fact, they could easily afford to do what they were doing. It didn't even miss it, whereas she gave everything she had. It's an interesting transition. It says, And as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, he leads into the next subject. I'm not sure what's going on. I suspect that as with so many of his comments, these little cryptic remarks that he doesn't bother to explain, he just kind of lays it out there and lets you fuss with it for a while. He makes this statement, look, she gave her whole living, and they gave out of their wealth. You can just see the crowd buzzing. Well, surely he can't mean that those two mites are more important than... I mean, look at that incredible gift over there that somebody gave in memorial to his great-grandfather. And look at that beautiful pew over there, and look at that beautiful gold thing. You know, I'm saying, they're talking about the temple. Look at this splendid temple. Jesus doesn't quarrel with any of that. It is a splendid temple. But he just moves right into the next subject. As for these things which you see, the days will come when there shall not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And they asked him, Teacher, when will this be? He predicts the collapse, the literal tearing apart, the destruction of the physical temple. They say, when will this be? And what will be the sign when this is about to take place? What follows is usually called the little apocalypse. It's sometimes called the Olivet Discourse, the Little Apocalypse or the Olivet Discourse. It's on the Mount of Olives. He's overlooking the city and in particular looking at the mighty temple, the great temple that was rebuilt, greater even than Solomon's temple. It's called the Temple of Herod because he had provided funds to be used for its splendor, an incredibly beautiful temple. Apocalypse, you may be familiar with that word and you may not. It's another name that we use for the book of Revelation. If you have a Roman Catholic version of the Bible, it probably calls the last book of the Bible the Apocalypse. There are many apocalypses, okay? It's a genre of literature. What it means is literature about the end of the world or the end of an age, the coming to an end of an epoch. There were lots of Jewish apocalypses. There were several Christian apocalypses. The most famous is what we call the book of Revelation, an apocalypse. It has to do with the end of the world or the end of an age. It is usually cataclysmic. Things exploding, blowing up, falling apart, collapsing. It's usually told in very vivid symbolic imagery, and of course that would be very much true of the book of Revelation. This passage before us today is usually called the Little Apocalypse. Jesus is addressing himself to the end of the age. The end of history as we have known it. Not the final end of history, but the end of history as we have known it. And in fact, What he's giving here is the answer to a double question. It's a double question. That is not entirely clear in Luke's version, the way I just read it to you. They ask the question, "Teacher, when will this be?" What is this? The destruction of the temple. When will this be? And what is the sign that this is about to take place? But if you read the same question as Matthew reports it, you'll see that they're really asking two things at once. Matthew's version is, "Tell us, when will this be, comma, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end or the close of this age?" Now, they're apparently assuming that those two events somehow go together. The collapse of the temple, the falling apart of religious worship as the Jews have known it up to this point, they assume will coincide with Christ's coming back in splendor and glory. Apparently. Jesus answers the question, but interestingly enough, he doesn't separate those two things out. He runs them all together just as the disciples ran them all together in raising the question. Part of his answer involves the thing that he's just predicted, namely the collapse of the temple, which we know historically took place in 70 AD. But he moves right on beyond that and talks about things of much greater consequence, literally the end of the age and his coming back. So that raises an interesting question. You know, why did he do it that way? Why didn't he separate those out and say, now, those are two different questions that you're raising. I can tell you about the collapse of the temple, but the issue of my coming back to set up my kingdom is much, much farther away, 2,000 years away, maybe more than that. Why didn't he separate those out? Well, I don't know. I wish he had, but he didn't. I would point out that there's a sense in which we are into the last days from at least the time of his ascension onward. There is a sense in which it doesn't feel like that to us as we think of the good old days back there in the first century. There's a sense in which folks in the first century saw themselves as living in the end times already. And you need to be aware of that. John, in writing his first epistle, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 18 says, "Children, it is the last hour." There's a sense of urgency all the way from the days of the apostles onward. There's a sense in which the apostles and everybody since are already into the last days. The next great event on the calendar is Christ's coming and establishing his kingdom, and we don't want to lose that. It hasn't yet happened for 2,000 years, and it may be a long time still in coming. My own opinion is that there's lots of reason to think that it's fairly near at hand, but lots of people have thought that in every generation, and they've been wrong thus far. So do you see what I'm saying? I think that's quite deliberate on his part. The disciples made the assumption that the temple being destroyed would herald Christ's coming to establish his kingdom, and he did not correct them on that. He let them think so because we need to live in the light of the urgency of his return. Okay? This discourse, this Olivet Discourse or this little apocalypse is reported in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's in Matthew 24 and 25. It's in Mark 13. And here it is in Luke 21. Matthew gives us by far the most complete reporting of the discourse. But almost everything that Matthew reports is here also in Luke and in Mark. It may be, as we've speculated before, that Matthew incorporates other sayings that Jesus said at various times and puts them all together as if they were said at this particular time. But basically, it's exactly the same discourse with just a little bit more elaboration. The question was, "Teacher, when will this be?" The collapse of the temple. "And what will be the sign of or signs of your coming?" As I've read through that material over and over again, I see 10 specific things that Jesus mentions. If you put all three accounts together, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus mentions 10 specific things that we ought to be looking for in terms of his coming back to establish his kingdom. I'm just going to move through this fairly quickly, and I hope that you'll go back and read this and meditate on it yourself, and I think it could lead into some very fruitful Bible study for you. You can just sort of follow along as I summarize. First thing is false prophets and false Christs. Many will come in my name, he says. Many will come claiming to be Messiah. Many will come talking about someone else saying, there he is. Go to him. He says that will be false. There will be many claims of Messiah coming. Verse 8, take heed that you are not led astray, for many will come in my name saying, I am he and the time is at hand. Do not go after them. Second sign, wars and rumors of wars. Conflict, international conflict. When you hear of wars and tumults, do not be terrified, for this must first take place, but the end will not be at once. Third is famines. Widespread hunger. People literally starving. Verse 10, nations will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. He's already alluded to that in terms of wars and rumors of wars. There will be great earthquakes and in various places famines and pestilences. So let's put in earthquakes as well as a fourth sign. Earthquakes, famines, you might want to add in addition to that pestilences. Now, the comment I'd make about those first four is that they have always been with us. These will be signs of the end, and yet we've had wars and rumors of wars. We'd have false prophets, false religions, false messiahs from day one. We've had famines forever. We have had earthquakes in various places and other kinds of disturbances in the history of mankind. They've always been here, so that doesn't speak awfully clearly to us. I think it might be fair to say that these things are intensifying, and you could anticipate them to be stepped up. The number of cults and occult kind of activity that is suddenly upon us is just absolutely astonishing. In the late 60s, all the social scientists were gleefully predicting the imminent demise of religion. Finally, man was coming of age, and we were going to put all this superstition behind us. We wouldn't believe in God or the gods or any of these supernatural powers, and all of a sudden, we've got more than we ever had before. Not only the real thing, but all the false counterfeits as well. Nobody expected that in the late 60s. It has certainly been true that we've had wars forever. I read somewhere that in all of recorded history, we estimate that there are only 260 years in which there was not warfare going on somewhere, sometime. So there have been wars all along, and yet I think the case can be made that the intensity and the severity of warfare has dramatically increased in our own generation, certainly in the 20th century. You know, as the year 1900 rolled around, people were again gleefully predicting that this was going to be the century without war. This was going to be the Christian century. And of course, it's been anything but. Suddenly we've got world war. Not once, but twice. And I think the case could be made that it never really has stopped. Do you know that since the official conclusion of World War II, there have been at least 50 separate wars? Okay, most of which are going on right now. Did you know that? Right now, in some form, there's been war and it's going on. So yeah, I think the case could be made that the intensity of this sort of thing, it's been with us all along, and yet it's speeded up, and suddenly everybody is deeply aware that we're facing the possibility of total annihilation but for the grace of God. Famines, again, you know, we've had famines for as long as there's been mankind, and yet as of the mid-70s, suddenly there was famine on a scale that was unprecedented, and tens of millions right now are literally starving to death because of the lack of food to feed them. Earthquake activity, that's one that you could argue about. People continue to talk about the growing probability that the whole St. Andrews Fault is shifting and we could lose the whole West Coast all the way up to the Aleutian Islands. That's speculation. Is it going to happen? I don't know. My point is that, yes, these signs have been around. And if you said, well, it doesn't really prove anything, they are not signs. They've been there from the beginning. Yes, that's true. And yet, they seem to be intensifying in our own day. A fifth sign, however, is this: tribulation and persecution of Christians. It says in verse 12, before all this, in other words, before all this is finalized, before I actually come back, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to their synagogues and prisons, and you'll be brought before kings and governors for my name's sake. This will be for a time for you to bear testimony. Settle it therefore in your minds not to meditate beforehand how to answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict. You will be delivered up even by parents and brothers and kinsmen and friends, and some of you they will put to death. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. But not a hair of your head will, and read in there, finally or utterly perish. In other words, the body they can kill. God's truth abideth still. By your endurance you will gain your eternal lives. Tribulation and persecution, and the skeptic says, aha, I've got you. Because that happened in the first century, right? Wrong. Do you know that in the first half of the 20th century there were more martyrs for Jesus Christ than in all 1900 years that preceded that put together? A time of tribulation and persecution. The sixth sign is not mentioned by Luke, but hold your finger here and turn back to Mark 13. Verse 10. Mark 13, verse 10. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Before I come back, the good news of the kingdom must be preached to all the nations. And again, the skeptic says, well, that happened centuries ago. No, as a matter of fact, it didn't. It was in 1956 that the American Bible Society released the long-awaited news item that finally the gospel of Jesus Christ, in whole or in part, has been published in the official language of every nation of the world. In most of our lifetimes, 1956. The job is still not done, mind you. Wycliffe would tell you there are something like, what, 3,000 tongues to go? Languages and dialects, people that do not have one single word of either Old or New Testament in their language. So the job is still not done in terms of the evangelization of the whole world. It is now in sight. It could be within this generation. Wycliffe is very hopeful that by the year 2000, the entire world will have heard. But it's an interesting statement. It's especially interesting because the word that here is preached is kerusso in Greek, which could equally well be translated published. The gospel must be published to all the nations. It does not say to each and every person. It does not say to each and every tribe. It does not say to every dialect and small clan grouping. It says to the nations. And so you see, that's literally come true in our generation. And there is more to go, and we need to be doing that more. But that's a very interesting sign, isn't it? the gospel in whole or in part has been published in the official language of every nation of the world. Seventh sign. Let me just put that one. Or did I miss one? Five was persecution. Persecution, martyrdom. Sixth was publish the gospel. And the seventh is what is here spoken of as the desolation of Jerusalem. Verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Both Matthew and Mark make that a little bit more specific. They talk about the desolating sacrilege. Hold your finger here and look at Matthew 24, verse 15. So when you see the desolating sacrilege spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place. Daniel speaks of that, and we usually translate it the abomination of desolation. Here Matthew and Mark pick that up, the desolating sacrilege. Again, what does that mean? I'm not sure. Daniel spoke of something standing literally in the Holy of Holies, something that would be an abomination to God. Most scholars think that that was fulfilled when Antiochus Epiphanes erected a statue of himself in the Holy of Holies and had pigs slaughtered and their blood thrown upon it in a deliberate mockery of bringing in the sacrificial blood to be put on the Holy of Holies. Interestingly enough, exactly the same thing happened under Caligula. He desecrated the Holy of Holies, came in and had a statue made of himself, and exactly the same thing. What does that continue to mean for us? Well, I don't know. It has been fulfilled, okay, at least twice. Will there be a fuller fulfillment? I don't know, but I'll share a private opinion with you that there couldn't be anything much more of an abomination on the site of the Holy of Holies than the Dome of the Rock is. Dedicated not to the God of Israel, not to the glory of Jesus Christ, but to the glory of Mohammed and Islam, and it sits right on the same site. Spectacular building. I mean, gloriously beautiful building, but it's an abomination. Now, whether there's something more than that, I don't know. There may well be. You know, I don't see the future. But I want to point out something very interesting to you about this statement. Again, you'll find it in both Matthew and Mark. Reading on from verse 15, Matthew 24, 15. So when you see the desolating sacrilege spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, parenthesis, let the reader understand. Close parenthesis. Now what's odd about that? Obviously, Jesus didn't say that, did he? He wasn't writing this down. He was speaking. Right? So when Matthew and Mark wrote it down, that's an editorial comment that they added. Jesus said, when you see the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. I suggest to you that Matthew and Mark saw that as something not for the hearers of Jesus' words, but for those who at some later date, maybe you and me, would read them. That's my suggestion to you. Jesus didn't say that. Obviously, they added it. And maybe, therefore, it's one of those things that you will not understand until it takes place. And then if you've done your homework, and if you know what to expect when it takes place, you'll recognize it. Do you follow me? Lots of things in the prophets are like that. I'm sure that many of the things that Isaiah, for instance, recorded as being prophecy from the throne room of God, he himself didn't have a clue as to what it meant. How could he? He faithfully wrote it down, and then as it took place, those who had done their homework and read Isaiah could recognize, aha, that's what it means. I'm sure that Isaiah must have really scratched his head when he heard God telling him to write down in the 53rd chapter that Messiah, my servant, will be cut off from the land of the living. He'll be killed. He'll be led like a lamb to the slaughter, but he shall prolong his days and see the fruit of the travail of his soul and be satisfied. How do you see the fruit of death and be satisfied? I'm sure Isaiah must say, I don't understand that one, Lord, but I'll write it down. And then as it happened and resurrection took place, people could say, yeah, that's right. There it is, right there in Isaiah. Do you follow me? Jewish friend of mine who was raised as an Orthodox Jew made the comment that much of prophecy is like looking at mountains far in the distance. And they appear to be just all in line with each other. They appear to be side by side. Then when you actually get up to them, you may find that some of them are miles and miles apart. But from a distance, they look as if they're all together. Perhaps that's part of why Jesus allowed these answers to be run together. As they're looking into the future, all these things appear to be side by side. As they actually begin to unfold in history, they're a good deal separated from each other. Okay? The desolating sacrilege. The abomination of desolation. Something in the very holy place that mocks God. Maybe it was Caligula. Maybe it is the Dome of the Rock. Maybe there's yet a deeper fulfillment to come. 8. The days are going to be shortened. Again, that's not in Luke. Neither is 9. It speaks of the sun, moon, and stars being darkened. That one does come in. Number 8 doesn't, the days being shortened. But number 9 does. Verse 25, there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars, and upon earth distress of nations, and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves. It does not say specifically darkened, but Matthew and Mark do. That's an interesting one. The darkening of the sun, moon, and stars. I can understand if something happens to the sun, then obviously the moon also is going to be affected, right? Because it just reflects. But it's hard to see how all the stars would simultaneously be darkened. In fact, it would almost seem that they would appear the brighter. If the moon's light was darkened, then the starlight would seem to shine all the brighter. Unless, of course, you put something in between you and the heavens that began to screen out their light. Now, again, it may mean something much more specific than that that I can't even imagine, but I'm interested that in Tokyo, the traffic cops have to take an oxygen break every 15 minutes, literally. And they're not calling it Los Angeles anymore, they're calling it Lost Angeles. Because you see, we literally are putting so much garbage into the atmosphere that some scientists are suggesting we're going to bring on another ice age by virtue of screening out the sun's rays. Others are suggesting the exact opposite, of course, that there'll be a greenhouse effect from putting all that stuff up there. But that's kind of interesting that he talks about the darkening of the sun, moon, and stars, and we're experiencing it right now. Again, I'm not sure that I know what the days being shortened means, but it sounds like there's a sense of the speeding up of time. Things that used to take much longer now happen almost instantly, like communication, like brewing coffee, like getting somewhere, like instant everything. Those first nine signs are shared throughout all three Gospels. As I said, two of them are not in Luke, one of them is not specifically in Luke, but they're basically there. The tenth one is uniquely to be found in Luke. And I think it's the most interesting of all, and it's the most important of all. I skipped over it. Verse 20, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart. And let not those who are out in the country enter it, for these are days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. Alas, for those who are with child and for those who give suck in those days. For great distress shall come upon the earth and wrath upon this people, and they'll fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations. And Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. In other words, Jerusalem, the ancient capital of Israel and Judah, Jerusalem will be a dominated city by Gentile power and authority, by external occupying forces, until nearly the end of this epoch, a period of time known as the times of the Gentiles, and those times will end. And Jerusalem will no longer be under Gentile dominion. It will revert to Jewish control and authority. Look at verse 29. He told them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they come out in leaf, you see for yourselves and know that the summer is already near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that the kingdom of God is near. The fig tree is always a symbol for Jerusalem, for Israel. He says, look at what's happening to the land. Look at what's happening to the city. Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Well, I trust that you're aware that Jerusalem was last a fully Jewish city in 586 BC. Brief moment under the Maccabees when it looked like it was going to be free again for the Jews, and then they were quickly put down. So by the time Jesus speaks these words, there have already been 600 years of Gentile dominion over the city of Jerusalem. 600 years. Three times as long as America has been in existence. Can you get the dynamics of that? And Jesus says it's going to go on until the times of the Gentiles are over, and then it's going to be a Jewish city once again. And people laughed. Jerusalem become Jewish again? You've got to be kidding. No way. And most Bible scholars for 1900 years took this as being a figure of speech, not literally so. Maybe the new Jerusalem, the church, is somehow going to be liberated in a new... No. May 1948, Israel is established in a single day, just like the prophet said it would be. June 1967, for the first time in 2,600 years, the city of Jerusalem becomes Jewish again. August 1980, the Knesset declares that the undivided city of Jerusalem will be the capital of Israel forever and ever. Amen. And there it is before you. Look at the fig tree. Look at the fig tree. I said at the outset, lots of people have thought previously that theirs was going to be the last generation, and they've been wrong, so I don't want us to go overboard but it sure seems to me as if there's powerful evidence that these things could have a culmination within our lifetimes. Jesus says the conclusion of this age is going to be a time of great anxiety for people who don't know God. Verse 25, signs in the sun, moon, and stars upon the earth, distress and perplexity, men fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world. For the very powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, you look up and raise your heads because your redemption is drawing near. You who have done your homework, you who know what to expect, don't be full of anxiety. Be full of great cheer, because the worse it gets out there, the closer is God's rescue at hand. That's interesting. There's a phrase here that, again, is usually misunderstood. Verse 32. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all has taken place. And the skeptic says, now I've got you for sure. Jesus thought it was going to happen in his own, within the lifetime of those disciples who were at hand. This generation will not pass away until everything is fulfilled. And obviously they all died. No, I don't think that's what it means. What generation? The generation that sees these things. The generation that sees what's happening to the fig tree. The generation that's around when the gospel is published to all the nations of the earth. That generation will be the one that sees my return. Time of anxiety. Notice verse 21. Sorry, that's not the verse I wanted. Verse 31. So also when you see these things taking place, you know that the kingdom of God is near. He says, verse 34, take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly like a snare. For it will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the whole earth. Please, friends, if you don't get anything else out of this talk, let that one lay to rest forevermore, the thought that the church is going to be snatched away before things really get bad. You will go through this, he says. It will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the earth. And the whole point of my telling you beforehand is that you might be prepared and that you'll know that the end is near and you'll have courage to go through it. It will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the whole earth. But you watch at all times, praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that will take place and to stand before the Son of Man. For us, the worse things get, the more we rejoice, for the closer is our victory. But we need to beware of picking up the attitudes and the practices of the world around us that doesn't know God and has no hope. He says, look up, for your redemption is drawing very near.